Senate Human Resources Committee to order, and we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 598. Want to talk about that?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 598 established the Pharmaceutical Patient Assistance Program in the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. Basically, what the bill does is develop a statewide network of trained volunteers to assist people who apply for the pharmaceutical companies and other types of patient assistance programs that offer free or discounted medications. We also have some Dash 1 proposed amendments with your packet, and basically what this the Dash 1 do is add community and organization patient assistance programs and volunteers to the bill, and then it requires the program to coordinate with the state health insurance assistance program that provides health benefit education, counseling, and assistance for people with Medicare. This is the SHEBA, or the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program in the Insurance Division. According to the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers of America website, there's over 150 pharmaceutical companies that offer some sort of patient assistance program. There's also several pharmaceutical companies that do a combination discount card that offers discounted medications. Thank you, Senator.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 598, and Jim Gardner, would you come up, please? I tried to get you before you sat down, but Ben Westland. Senator Westland. Senator, would you like to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland is here to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 598. This is obviously a bill that addresses a much-needed issue. I would go as far as say an issue that is approaching a medical crisis in this state. It allows Oregon residents to gain free or extremely reduced cost access to prescription medications through a prescription drug assistance program offered by our pharmaceutical manufacturers. Currently, at least as of 2004, there are over 93,000 Oregonians accessing their medication through programs similar to this. I think it's fair to say that at this juncture, that is probably well over 100,000 at this point in time. I don't need to explain this need or question the understanding of the committee. We're all well aware of this problem, and Senate Bill 598 goes a long way in systemizing and addressing a much-needed medical issue in this state. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is the trade association that represents the majority of the major drug manufacturers. We would like to join Senator Westland in support of this bill, and particularly to commend Senator Bates for his vision in seeing the need for a program like this and introducing it. As Senator Bates will relate to you undoubtedly, the program is really inspired by a very successful effort in the area of in his district, which he as a physician has made extensive use of. The real challenge with regard to these free drug programs is simply getting people access to them, getting people familiar with them, and then particularly for elderly people, getting them help filling out the application forms. We're doing everything we can to simplify that form. We're in a process of continuous improvement to try to make it easier, and I think the numbers speak for themselves. In the last 3 years, the participation has grown from roughly 30,000 individuals, and that's individuals, not prescriptions, individuals in Oregon, to now audited numbers for 2004, 93,000, and very clearly over 100,000 at this point. We think there is potential for further dramatic growth. And just by way of comparison, that's roughly four times the size of OHP standard. So we want to put our shoulder to the wheel, and we think this is a way that the state can, in a very, very cost-effective manner, help Oregonians to gain free access to these life-saving medications. We'd commend the bill to your attention.
A question. And you're going to work with the Oregon Prescription Bulk Purchasing Program to fill the gaps between your program and that program to make sure that everyone in Oregon is covered somehow by prescription drugs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very privileged to serve on the work group which you have convened. We're in the process of now developing that matrix which will identify where the gaps are, and then coming forward with ideas for how to address those gaps. We think that a major part of that effort that's particularly valuable for the state, since it does not involve expenditures beyond simply the informational asset, since the product is free, are these programs. But we're committed. I think our actions speak louder than words in terms of our commitment to helping poor and elderly Oregonians get the life-saving drugs they need.
I write that down.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I think the issue here is it's the logistics of distribution, as exemplified by people either A, knowing about these programs, or when they do, the ease and capability of making the application. And as in Senator Bates's district, they have their volunteer clinic, and in Bend we have our volunteers and medicine clinic, and they have a full-time facilitator that sits there at the window and does nothing but help people access these pharmaceuticals that are generously and graciously supplied in large numbers, expensive drugs, by the folks from pharma. So this is a very collaborative effort, and one that I think we should make sure we pay close attention to.
Okay. Good. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Mark. Thank you, Chair. I would like to... The problem I have with the bill is it's asking for general fund money, and I would love to see the pharmaceuticals come up with the money to help this out rather than taking general fund money. This is and I don't know how that or if that could be done, but that's my main concern. We just don't have the revenue. I know that this will I don't know if the cost will is that excessive where it would go to Ways and Means, but at this point I would love to see you develop the program and help the nonprofit organizations have the money to help our patients access these drugs. Just point of conversation. I was wondering if you could react to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, we did. I had suggested that the bill include section 1, paren 2, which is a sort of standard clause that says you can accept contributions to help fund the program, and I think there are certainly some. I cannot offer any financial commitments. I think there could be some sources of funds, foundation funding, either within the industry foundations and the like. Personally think it might help to spark those or catalyze those if the state, makes some effort itself. When we had some initial discussions that indicated that it might be able to be done within existing resources, maybe somebody's time who's already on the staff of OPR. We're obviously cognizant of the financial strictures that the state is suffering under, and I think the level of funding that you and Ways and Means decides to put on it is a sort of a separate discussion, but we view it as Senator Westland put it, as a collaboration, and I think ideally you can draw upon a number of resources to make it happen.
Just follow.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just very difficult for me to want to support something to make your business better. I mean, that's how I view this, because I think your programs are fantastic, and I actually have referred a couple of my constituents to these programs that you have been providing us, and it is a marketing, and I can see the collaboration as long as it wouldn't cost us any money.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Senator Morris Anderson, I appreciate your perspective, but I actually think that in the structure of this and being a statewide program and being able to expand it, not in terms of fiscal impact on the general fund, I do think it's important that the state be involved in what would be a de minimis amount of money. Part of that's just he who's got the gold makes the rules, and making sure this gets off to exactly the right state or right start that I think it needs to get off to. And let me just further say that in, I won't go so far as to say extensive negotiations with Mr. Gardner, but in conversations with Mr. Gardner, I do believe that there would be not only pharmaceuticals but financial assistance coming from pharma or the pharmaceutical companies that I do not think should relieve the state's responsibility for a small, and by small I mean very small, contribution to have a seat at that fiscal table. So a little bit of six of this, half a dozen of another, but I do think it's important that the state have a financial commitment to this program, de minimis as it would be.
Okay.
Yes. I guess. I mean, when you look at the, I mean, we're talking about profit here. I'm not sure that I can go there. I mean, these are reduced price programs, and some of them are free. I'm not sure where the profit is in this. This is the pharmaceutical industry stepping up the plate in a huge way, and by creating this program, we're going to increase access to a program that doesn't have profit in it. And I think we need to have this in perspective, and I agree, Senator Westland, we aren't talking about a whole lot of state money to make this happen, but the fact is that we're dealing with individual entities in the different pharmaceutical companies that, for some very important reasons, can only collaborate to a point. And so to have an entity in the state that can coordinate those things is the only way we can make this happen. And I think this is an incredibly good step, and I think it's, when you look at what the pharmaceutical industry has done just this year and the expansion of their program, it's huge. And so to say this is driven by profit, I think, is totally wrong.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Scott Gallen, Tom Holt, please. Is it okay to call you guys together? Is that okay?
You can keep the chair in between you and you'll be
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Gallant with Oregon Medical Association. I don't believe I was going to hurt Mr. Holt on this bill, actually. The concept is one that is worthy of consideration by the committee. It's actually been discussed for a series of sessions in order to try to coordinate activities that, in fact, a lot of county medical societies, physicians' offices and clinics are doing, and many of them have, in fact, hired personnel to just deal with this issue. So I think there is a commitment from the medical community to help individuals who could not otherwise afford or have access to appropriate medications. It's a serious issue. To maybe respond or comment regarding a program of this type where there may be some appropriation, Last session, the legislature adopted a bill on patient safety, which, in our opinion, the medical community, hospitals, and others who supported that legislation believe is a very critical issue, not only for the state, but federally. And the legislature, due to its limits of resources appropriated $1 to meet the fiscal responsibility for that bill. And the medical community, hospitals, and others have voluntarily contributed a significant amount of resources to enable that commission to perform what we believe is a very, very important responsibility. I can assure you that at some point in the future, you know, we will ask the legislature, if this is serious policy to them, to appropriate funds at a improved level. But I think this issue affects a lot of lives as well. And having the legislation on the books, maybe with a minimal amount of appropriations, is appropriate so that we can coordinate these activities on a statewide basis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Like Mr. Gallant's members, our members see this issue on the front line of people who come into the pharmacy and they can't afford the prescription therapy that they need to maintain their health. So we think that it is a good thing to have in statute a coordination of effort to get people through the qualifications and paperwork that's required to get into these programs. They are substantial. There are some things going on in the private marketplace to assist people, but to some degree they're a bit disturbing. I've seen reports of things over the web where they charge $300 and $400 to do this for an individual to help them with their paperwork and so on. And these are people who don't have the $300 or $400. That's why they need the assistance. The legislature has looked at this issue before. I recall in the 2001 session, we passed Senate Bill 9 and made a provision for creating a program at the College of Pharmacy. No money was ever appropriated. No provision was made in that bill to accept donations for the program. And consequently, the College of Pharmacy was never able to get it going, other than beyond what they're able to task some students to do. So we think this bill is a good effort to, you know, help people get some help that's available, who need some help. It potentially is a good way to leverage a few dollars into a lot of dollars worth of benefit.
Questions? Yeah, go ahead.
When you had the program that you couldn't get off, did you have someone trying to coordinate getting money? Did you approach pharmaceuticals? Did you?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moss Anderson, what I can tell you, I don't know all the details, but what I can tell you is that the significant difference here, I think, is that Bill would be assigning the task to, you know, an existing office that's sort of set up to deal with these types of this and other types of health programs. The College of Pharmacy is set up to, you know, be a school, and they didn't have staff that they could really dedicate to setting aside to work on it. And I don't know all the particulars of why they weren't able to get grant money. So I just know that they were not successful in doing so.
What role would pharmacists play in this?
Chair Morissette, typically in these programs, once someone is qualified, they receive the medications either directly from the manufacturer or through their physician's office. They don't receive them through the pharmacy.
Okay.
So the only pharmacy role or pharmacist role is just to make sure that they are aware of those medications being received so that they can continue to run the proper drug interaction profiles and those sorts of things that they do on the rest of their medications.
What role will the pharmacist play in promoting the program?
Chair Morissette, we would help promote it as we do some other things. We make information available and through pharmacies. Sometimes we do bag stuffers as a service and do things on, through websites and other means that we have available that are fairly low cost.
Would you volunteer pharmacists? Well, it would be up to the pharmacist, but would you recommend volunteering some of their time, some of their resources to make this program a success, because obviously we need money?
Chair Morissette, what I can say is that we would make the program known as best we can through pharmacies. I'm not in a position to make commitments.
Just thought I'd ask.
Although, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of very close friends who are pharmacists. And they do a lot of charity care, so to speak.
Good. So we can count on them.
We need names and days of the week. So,
okay. Thank you. Senator Bates just walked in, for better or for worse, and he's shaking his head. So, would you like to address the group? Or? Just for a moment, yes. Senator Bates. We're talking about resources now.
We've moved completely off topic, huh? For the record, I'm Senator Alan Bates, state senator from Southern Oregon, Ashland and Medford. Geez, I get used to that. Spent some time this morning at the House, and I still feel like I'm back in the House again all of a sudden. First, I'm going to apologize to the committee for the number on this bill. We've all been laughing about it for a long time.
No, this is 598.
Oh, we're on 598. Thanks. I'll qualify right by apologizing for the previous number. Okay. I don't know how I got stuck with 666 in the previous one, but it's there. And 598 is coming up. I know you're hearing both of them today, and I was actually tied up with it. Patient problem for the last hour, so I'm sorry that I'm not up to speed here. You've probably heard all the pros and cons of this bill already, and the key thing from my point of view, this is a opt-in and not an opt-out, and that makes something I think will make it work. Those who want to take advantage of it can, those who do not want to will not. I think the program will slowly grow, because right now we're going to be facing an increasing difficulty with substitution when the Medicare benefit comes in. That's going to be something difficult to work on.
What? Substitution? This is 598.
This is the
You've got so many bills.
Assistance program.
Yeah, but the PPA program?
Yeah.
I'm really mixed up. Sorry. Taking my mind off my face.
Sponsored by Senator Bates.
Yeah, I've sponsored both these bills. I'm up to embarrass myself.
You sponsored too many bills.
Yeah. PPA, okay, you've already discussed 666.
Yes. No, that's NASS.
Mr. Chair.
Could I, Senator Bates.
Could you step down, please?
I do have a real question. Senator Westland and others have spoke to the bill. It's a great program, and I want to thank you for bringing it forward. The Dash 1 amendments, I'm assuming are yours. Is everybody in agreement with the Dash 1 amendments?
At this point, they are. We still have an issue, a major issue to deal with in this bill, and that is if we actually were to put it in place, we have not decided or do we have agreement on what agency would handle this at the state level. And that's one of the issues we still have to deal with. The PPA, the Patient Prescription Assistance Program, has worked extremely well in our area. I'd like to see it continued, but I have to warn you, we have one piece yet to put in place, and that's not in place at this time. And until that gets put in place, I don't think this bill should move forward. Having a hearing is appropriate, and I appreciate it. Now I know which bill we're on, helps out.
Okay. But Mr. Chair, but other than that one issue, the amendments make it a pretty clean bill.
Yes,
from your
the rest of it I think is clean and should go through. But that piece is a big piece we have to resolve.
Okay.
I'm going to... Don't go away.
I would like to go away.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 598, which we will come back to because we have some other people to testify, and we will open a public hearing on Central 666, so go for it.
Okay, this will be very quick. Trust me, I'm already halfway there. Again, I apologize for the number. We've been at some real ribbing on this. I suppose I should say for the record that Alan Bates, state senator, who believes he knows what the bill he's talking about now. 666 is trying to resolve an issue that was brought to us by the pharmacist and a problem also for practicing physicians, in that you commonly find yourself in a position that you are writing a prescription for a patient. There is a substitution to be made if that particular drug is not covered by their prescription plan. And quite often these substitutions are drugs that are so close together you don't feel uncomfortable making the switch. But the time it takes to make that switch is amazing. By the time the pharmacist finds out which drug it is that can be substituted, and then he calls you back at your office, then you've already left the office or are not available. Phone calls go back and forth for quite a while. The patient gets very upset they haven't got the prescription filled. And ultimately, you get the job done. You can go in some pharmacists, some pharmacies, and see a stack of these waiting for a call back from a physician to okay a change or not to okay a change. So maybe times there's a reason you don't want that to happen. In the setting of a hospital, we have an automatic way of making those substitutions, but they have a committee that looks at those very carefully, monitors it carefully, and makes sure it doesn't occur inappropriately. In the setting outside the hospital, it's a lot more open and more difficult to make that happen. The state of Washington set up a similar program to this in the very restricted areas of the pharmaceutical industry, and it is working reasonably well there. This is a program we want to have available for those physicians who want to take part in it and would not be available or be forced on any physician that doesn't want to. That's the part we're talking about where it's an opt-in. Physician can say, yes, I'd like to take part in that. These are the drugs that I would allow to be switched for my patients. Save those phone calls, make it more efficient, get the right prescription to the patient. There are issues here if you're not careful with patient safety, and they have to be. I think they've been addressed properly. And at this point, I think we are within a couple of days having final language and amendment presented to you, which will represent what I'm talking about. I talked to OMA this morning, and the pharmacist. They have language of which they think answers problems of patient safety, answers problems of being able to opt in for a physician, should make it a viable and workable program. It's a program I expect that we will see grow in some areas where physicians want to use it, and then other physicians may feel uncomfortable and will never use it, and that's their prerogative. I think it's something that's worthwhile moving forward, something we can make work, and I would suggest that once we get that amendment to you with the proper language, which should be available in the next few days, that you can move it forward.
Good. Thank you. Question? Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you say that this would, that the physician and the pharmacist would make an agreement ahead of time that the pharmacist could do that?
It would probably be the form when you wrote the prescription that on that particular patient for that particular drug, you could check that you will allow substitution and you would already know what the substitution possibilities were.
Okay. Just follow up.
Yes.
I did have a medication I was on, and the pharmacist substituted it, and I wasn't told until after I walked outside and then started reading and said, oh, this isn't my pill, you know, my medication. And I went back in and, you know, I said, no, I don't want you to give it to me because I didn't have a PDR. I didn't a drug list to see what. And so I have a concern from that point of view. And then the second question is, it says a practitioner, the last sentence, a practitioner who prescribes a drug is not liable for any side effects or adverse reactions caused by the manner or method by which a substituted drug product is selected. So that would mean that the pharmacist would be held liable. Is that?
I believe you'll, Mr. Yes. Chair and Senator Anderson, I think you'll find that the amended language will take care of that difficulty.
Okay.
There obviously is some shared concern here, but what it comes back to, I believe, is the doctrine of captain of the ship. Ultimately, the physician is responsible. He has made an arrangement to have that substitution to be allowed if he decides to go into the program. And when if he goes into that program, he understands clearly he or she is making that decision. Going back to your first question, you experienced, I expect, although I did not see that prescription, a substitution from a brand name to a generic.
I'm sure.
That's probably what it was. Under Oregon law, that can be done now without a knowledge of the physician, unless the physician writes specifically, do not substitute, or similar language on the prescription. I would hope that a pharmacist would say, this is a generic drug, you know, there's a chance for savings or something of that nature. Would you accept this and not just hand it to you? I'm not sure that always happens. In this particular issue, we're talking about something that's quite different from that. We're talking about having a class of drugs that are all very similar. So similar that that the insurance companies feel they can be moved from one to the other without significant risk to the patient. And so we're talking about something quite different here, and that needs to be clear to this committee. I don't want you to be voting on something that you later feel that you weren't having full disclosure on. I'll give you an example. There's a group of drugs that are used for gastric problems, primary ulcers, and you may have heard of some of them, Nexium, Prilosec, Prevacid. There's a group of five there. Those are five drugs that commonly can be substituted and are substituted for each other in the setting of the hospital. That's the type of thing we'd be looking at. You'll find many insurance companies will pay for one of those, but not the others, and allow to make an automatic substitution if the physicians so chose in that particular group of drugs in that very narrow range. And they'd have to mark it on the prescription when they send it in to the pharmacy. That makes sense to you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry about the early confusion, but it's sort of a record.
Well, thank you for being
here.
Thank you.
And thank you for your time and for your patience. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to close the hearing temporarily on 666 and move back to Senate Bill 598. Open the public hearing at 598. Crystal Otis and Angela Kimball, would you please come up? Now, keep in mind, we're not going to have a work session on this, so you'll have another chance later, perhaps. So we're going to keep it brief and move on.
People want this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chris Otis, the executive director with the Oregon chapter of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, here to provide testimony in support of SB 598. I think we've heard a number of comments about the nature of health care in this state and the needs of un- and underinsured individuals and the number of those individuals. Certainly there have been comments about the pharmaceutical industry and their willingness to step to the table to try to meet some of those needs. From our perspective, there is a huge need. There's been an effort to meet that need, and the issue now before us is really one of how to connect those people in need of the service and the people that are willing to provide it. From our perspective, I'm representing Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, Cystic Fibrosis patients across the country. They number 30,000 people, and in this state we're estimating about 400 individuals affected by the disease. This is a group of individuals who have an ongoing and very critical need to access medications, and there are some estimates that place the dollar amount of these prescriptions and other medical therapies for these individuals in excess of $40,000 a year. Some of our patients are fortunate enough to have insurance that covers the bulk of those medical needs, but there are certainly a huge number of them who are either under or uninsured, and it's this population who we believe could most benefit from the program provided and put forward in SB 598. If I could just share one brief story to sort of underscore the personal effect that this bill the need that it might help meet. Our organization is engaged with a variety of individuals, CF patients and their families, on a number of different activities and programs. One of the things that we try to do is be a resource for these individuals and a point of information and service for them. We frequently, and sort of anecdotally, I can tell you on a more frequent basis, receive calls from individuals who are having trouble accessing medications, either because their insurance needs or their insurance programs have changed, their employment situations have changed, thereby with a resulting change in their insurance coverage. And at best, we've been able to point them in the direction of services and programs that might benefit them. Certainly, we appreciate the work that pharma and the pharmaceutical companies have done in this regard and have used them as a primary source for these individuals. We certainly coordinate with our local medical partner, the CF Care Center up at OHSU, and their social worker, again, to guide people in the direction of services that they need. And here's a case in point. There's an individual that we worked with, a gentleman, 35 or so, CF patient, who unfortunately died about a year ago of complications related to cystic fibrosis. And we had occasion to know him and to work with him, and he was engaged with our organization in a variety of different activities. Shortly after his death, I had a call from a relative of his who wanted to talk about this individual, but very specifically to pass on some information and to offer some assistance to us. He said he had worked with his relative, and I'll call him Joe because of confidentiality reasons, but anyway, Joe, on over the last several months of his life to help him access medications that he needed to sustain and support him. And Joe had been very fully employed for a lot of years of his life, and towards the end, because of complications of his disease, had seen his employment situation change, and as a result, his insurance situation change, and he was on state-supported programs. And this gentleman shared with me the fact that he spent hours and hours of time and weeks doing research on the different programs that were available to someone in this kind of situation, and was able, fortunately, to hook him up with the resources that he needed. But what he wanted to impart to me was the fact that the hurdles that he jumped through and the paperwork and the process were very intimidating for him. And it was a very difficult process at best. So he offered to certainly be of assistance to us if we needed to send other individuals to talk with him. And I share that with you because this is a situation where the CF patient had somebody who was very much an advocate for him and was really working hard to get him the services and the medications that he needed. And we know that there are probably 100,000 people being reached now by the programs that are in place for prescription programs and medical assistance. But imagine the number of people that could be reached if we actually had a network of volunteers and individuals who were versed in how to work the process and navigate through the system so that we could bring life-saving medications to people who very much needed them. So in closing, I would just urge your support for this piece of legislation that, at least in our eyes, has very much of an upside for a lot of individuals. Thank you.
Thank you. Angela?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. The speakers before me have articulated the merits of this bill extensively, so I'll simply add that community mental health programs, with the reductions in OHP standard and with the medically needy program, have definitely seen a huge number of patients who've required the assistance of patient assistance programs because of their loss of coverage. We are spending time and resources trying to hook people up with programs in some cases. In other cases, those resources aren't available. And we get calls from people who don't have that access. I think this kind of program is invaluable. It'll free up resources, mental health professionals, who could be better deployed actually providing treatment rather than doing paperwork to try and access medication. We think this is a wonderful example of private-public collaboration and urge your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing once again on Senate Bill 598 and reopen the public hearing once again on Senate Bill 666. And Tom Holt and Scott Gallant, would you please come up? And Jim Gardner, is Jim? Well, okay. Yeah.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association here in support of Senate Bill 666, an auspiciously numbered bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's Senator Bates described very well, I think, the administrative burden that has evolved relating to the prescribing process, and that's the impetus for this bill. Where we are today in terms of third-party payment or insurance payment for prescription drugs is that around 85% of those who come into a retail pharmacy have some form of insurance coverage. When Medicare Part D kicks in, that's going to go well over 90%. The result is that pharmacists are now spending, and their staffs are spending, just over 20% of their time just doing what we call coordination of benefits with prescription drugs, making sure that the drug therapy is something that the patient can actually get coverage for, or that they can afford if they don't have coverage. So the intent of the bill is not really to change the end result. We know what the end result is going to be in most cases. If a patient's drug plan covers drug A at a favorable copay and doesn't cover drug B, in most cases, the physician is going to say, okay, switch to drug A if that's where the advantage is for the patient, if there's not a substantial therapeutic difference. And the same is true if someone does not have coverage at all. We still have to make a lot of communication back and forth, which takes time with the physician's office. What we will have in the form of amendments is a little different approach to the bill than from what was drafted. What we will have is, as Senator Bates described, an opt-in system where a physician would have total control over whether or not they wish to participate in this. They would choose whether or not to allow a therapeutic interchange to take place within a drug class. They could rely on previously arranged protocols with the pharmacist. They could also rely upon the formularies and pharmacy and therapeutics committees determinations. We'll bring that all back to you in considerable detail, we think, within a few days. I do want to speak to the liability question that Senator Moss Anderson asked. It is our intent in the bill, and will be in the amendments, that to the extent that pharmacists have a greater decision-making authority here, the pharmacist will bear the liability for that decision and not the physician who has not made that decision. We want to make sure that the liability is pointed to the right place. We've been working with Mr. Gallant and his colleagues over the last couple of weeks to develop amendments, and we hope to have those back to you very soon. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Sure. Yes, Senator Cruz. The liability issue looks like a lawyer's dream to me. Do you have any idea what that potentially could cost as far as your tort liability? Because you're opening yourself up absolutely wide open here, I think. I see a huge potential downside to that. What kind of read have you got on that at this point?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, we have consulted with Pharmacist Mutual, which is the largest liability insurer for pharmacists in the country. They have reviewed the language in the bill, and as it was presented, they haven't had a chance to review our amendment language, but in general concept, they have told us that they don't believe it would have really give them any heartburn at all in terms of liability, in large part because they already have a substantial amount of experience with the Washington program, which is what we're really modeling. They are fully supportive of the concept.
Currently, a pharmacist fills a prescription, there are side effects, you have no liability at all at this point, do you?
Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, that's not quite the case. There was an Oregon Supreme Court case a couple of years ago that decided that issue. And there used to be what was called a doctrine of a learned intermediary, as the court called it. And I'm treading on the thin ice, as I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but the gist of it was that prior to that decision, the pharmacist could have as a defense, well, I just did what the physician ordered me to do.
Right.
And the court said, no, not good enough. You also have a professional duty, and you are liable for providing full information to the patient and so on, and including about side effects and anticipating those side effects. And we're happy to bear that. It's where the profession's headed.
And so, Mr. Chair, so moving from second chair to first chair isn't really going to impact you that much? I mean, because right now you're second chair in that, because obviously the prescribing physician is first chair, but if you make a substitution, then you move to the first chair, I'm assuming, and you probably relieve the physician of any liability because you're the one that made the substitution.
Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, I'm not quite sure I would agree with the characterization of moving to the first chair and that the physician remains in control of whether or not a substitution would take place to begin with. But we're also really, the practical reality is that we're not really in going to be changing the outcome of what the patient gets for a drug therapy. What we're going to change is the administrative process that goes on before the patient receives the prescription drug.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for him, too. Thank you.
Are
there broad areas that you would substitute? I guess I'm trying to get at, would it just be focused on just certain types of classes of drugs? For instance, I can't imagine substituting maybe, well, maybe you can, insulin versus maybe substituting for blood pressure. I was just wondering, are there categories that you...
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, part of our amendments will include some categories where therapeutic interchanges would not be allowed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, Scott. Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Scott Gallen. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. As this bill was originally printed, the OMA could only support the bold language in line one of the bill. We have...
Reluctantly at that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
Actually, if we remove that, then there...
Well, we could support the... Well, I'm not sure we like the description of the bill as it's originally written, so we'd have to negotiate over that. But seriously, we have taken a lot of time and effort to try to put a structure that we think is much more narrow in this bill and a series of amendments, and I'll describe them very briefly. These amendments do need some additional work as has previously been indicated, and we need to recheck with both of our leaderships and others as well. But the bill is, we would amend the bill to specifically define what therapeutic alternates means. And what therapeutic interchange means is based off of federal language that both the American Medical Association and Mr. Holt's national organization have agreed are appropriate definitional changes. We will also propose that the dosage and dosage form would not be changed as original law currently provides, which we believe is important. We will also be proposing that antipsychotics, antidepressants, essentially AIDS, HIV medications, and chemotherapy medications, and I believe one other area, would be specifically excluded from the provisions of this law. If it's adopted. In addition to that, this would provide for a physician to opt into an agreement to permit interchange to occur. It would be solely at the discretion of the physician to do that for individual patients. They could also agree to a formulary or protocol as well that both parties would agree to if in fact they choose to participate at all in this program. Again, many healthcare facilities, which are not just hospitals but could be nursing homes or others, have P&T pharmacy and therapeutics committees that review medications and formularies and appropriate medications. In those settings, those would still continue. It would still be the responsibility of a physician to make a determination whether or not to go down this particular path. And in the outpatient setting, it would be up to the prescribing physician. Specifically, in regard to liability, which I think has been raised a couple of times, and I know that Mr. Holt and his counsel or carrier, primary carrier, has not reviewed the language, we do provide language that would make it clear that a pharmacist would be responsible for any liability that might occur as a result of this bill. As the original bill was drafted, and I think I mentioned this in a couple of small group vote meetings, as I like to call them, the original language, in our opinion, retained all liability on the physician's behalf, which we didn't particularly view as a positive along the way. So there will be significant amendments to this bill, and which we think materially improves the original draft.
Okay. Thank you. Rich, thank you. Jim Gardner, would you please come up? Is this news from Pharma Central?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, appearing for Pharma, and alas, our spirit of harmony over Senate Bill 598 has come to an end, and I find myself in opposition to my good friends Scott Gallant and Tom Holt, and indeed Senator Bates on Senate Bill 666. Every time I ask for a copy of this bill in the bill room, they act like it's on fire or something because of the number. The statement you have from Pharma basically, and I let me begin by saying this is a very, very old issue. I can't tell you how many years I have been dealing with the issue of therapeutic substitution in this building and before the Board of Pharmacy. A very old issue. And it's really the same issue that's presented here.
Just a moment. Did you deal with this when you were a senator?
I don't remember, Mr. Chair. I probably did. but certainly soon thereafter.
Really old.
Really old. And it's always sort of the same arguments. It's more convenient if we just sort of delegate to the pharmacists. And, you know, we can put protocols that will curb the discretion. And then the sort of new nuance on that, well, it takes the doctor's time and the pharmacist's time to try to figure out what drugs are on this particular HMO's formulary versus that one. I can't keep it all straight, et cetera, et cetera. And I would submit to you there are basically two approaches to dealing with that legitimate administrative challenge that occurs in the physician's office. The first, which we think is the right approach, is to accelerate the existing trend toward electronic prescribing, toward databases, toward keeping, in some manageable way, keeping that data in front of the prescriber so that it eliminates the friction in the system. And that, I can assure you, is a project that is well underway. Physician groups like Kaiser and others are moving toward electronic prescribing in big chunks. When that occurs, when that transition is complete, this issue will vanish. This issue that Dr. Bates has brought to you will simply disappear because you will know, the prescriber will know at the point of prescribing what's on this patient's HMO's drug list, what would require prior authorization, what wouldn't. That's, we think, the proper solution to the problem. Now, what's the other path? The other path is essentially for, in one way, shape, or form, or another, for the prescriber to delegate the authority to pick the drug within a particular therapeutic class to someone else, to, in this case, the pharmacist. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, it is probably more convenient for the prescriber to do that on occasion, but that's not the point of the safeguard and double check system we have right now in the law. The point of it is to require the prescribing physician in each and every instance to make an individualized decision that this drug is the right drug for this particular patient. Not say I'm going to just, you know, sort of wholesale delegate for this class, or even for this patient, I'm going to delegate the decision to someone else, to the pharmacist. I think the risk that's associated with this has been minimized. Let me give you an example, a drug class that was not mentioned, and that's long-acting opioids, which is a pain reliever for people that have very severe pain. If you were to look, for instance, at the preferred drug list developed pursuant to the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan, our own Medicaid fee-for-service drug list, you would find, for instance, in that therapeutic class, the drug methadone. Now, the drug methadone is very cheap. It is an analgesic. It does relieve pain, but it has a very complex pharmacology. Specifically, it has a very long half-life. And if you are allowed to substitute that drug within that class for the drug prescribed that may not have as long a half-life, you will risk contributing to what state epidemiologist has characterized as our mini-epidemic in methadone deaths. There are grave risks associated with divorcing the decision as to what drug to prescribe, putting that even voluntarily out of the hands of the prescribing physician. I think we ought to err on the side of patient safety and push with all our might to get technology to catch up and deal with the real problem, which is getting the right information into the hand of the physician. Let me talk a little bit about liability. And to be very candid, one of the reasons that pharma is concerned about this is because when patient safety is compromised, our liability increases. Even if it's no fault of our own, we're always brought into these lawsuits. And so our interest in this instance and the interest in patient safety, the patient's interest, are perfectly and exactly aligned. They're in exactly the same spot. If the decision is made by a physician to say, okay, I'm going to allow for this patient therapeutic substitution to occur within the class of long-acting opioids, the example I just gave. And if that physician knows or should have known that one of the drugs in that class, methadone, has a peculiar pharmacology which can create particular risks, is it really appropriate to grant amnesty for that decision to make the delegation, amnesty to the physician? Is that really appropriate? Isn't there some accountability that's appropriate for the very decision to authorize the delegation? So I think that's just one of the issues that's raised by this bill. I think there's a better approach to what we all agree is the problem, which is better informing the physician.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 666, and we are going to hear Senate Bill 403. No, wait. Okay, we're going to skip. Well, we're going to open the public hearing on 403. Senate Bill 403. We'll come back to that. Yes.
Thank you, Senator. We did hear Senate Bill 403 This is the third time we're hearing it. The bill basically allows a $10,000 tax credit for physicians whose practice is at least 6% rural or medical staff in a rural hospital. And it does require the Department of Revenue to adjust this number annually using the Consumer Price Index. We do have two sets of amendments with this bill. One would include pharmacists who are not part of a group of five pharmacies under common ownership. The dash two amendments also in your packet would include psychologists in the bill. That would not begin until on or after 2009. This bill does have a subsequent referral to revenue. Also, part of the reason for holding the bill over to this meeting was that there was some debate about whether or not the current bill includes the whole scope of practitioners currently in the program, and according to some discussion with legislative counsel, the bill as written does include that full scope of practitioners, including MDs, DOs, podiatrists, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and such. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Farrielli, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, State Senator Ted Farrielli, for the record. I just am here to voice my continuing support for this important piece of legislation and to urge all possible dispatch in moving the bill forward.
Okay. Now, are you from Portland?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I was born on the east side of the Cascade Mountains in Spokane, Washington, and have the privilege of being educated in Portland, raised there, and then moving to Creswell, and by way of Creswell to John Day, where I now reside.
You represent...
It was my intention to make you regret that question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I remember when you were from Creswell. I think we worked together at that time.
We did. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I will never forget you standing shoulder to shoulder with 12,000 forest product workers at a rally in Portland for showing solidarity with displaced timber workers.
That's right.
Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. So tell us about your support of this law. Let me rephrase the question. We have expanded the coverage to all of those people who have been in the previously covered, but we also put in the psychologist, where that is an amendment to include. Are you okay with that?
I would have no objection, Mr. Chairman, to including other practitioners, okay, as long as they have MD or PhD or are somehow involved in the continuum of healthcare practice.
Okay. Senator, Representative Butler from Ontario has a bill that would include psychologists, something similar to this. And at his urging, we are including them in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if we can pass one bill and avoid passing another, that's a great thing. You know, get a two-for-one with one bill.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to appear once again before this committee.
It's an honor for the committee. Ed Patterson, Scott Gallant, would you come up? Scott, you want to come up? Is he here? Yes, he's here. Okay. Ed Patterson.
Aren't you glad you're back from D.C., Scott?
Indiana, Tom. Hey. A changing cast of characters. Or I should say an unchanging cast of characters. Ed, are you ready to start?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Ed Patterson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Health Association. I'm here to support Senate Bill 403 today. This is my third time being here to support Senate Bill 403. And you'll notice when the testimony is passed out, it'll have a date of March 15th, which was the last time I was here to appear for 403. I didn't bother replaying it. Mr. Chair, the key for any rural community to create economic development, population stability, and a desirable living environment is to have a sustainable rural health delivery system. To attain a desirable rural health delivery system, the community must have reasonable access to a hospital, and the hospital must be able to recruit and retain physicians. The reality is that physicians can make a lot more money practicing in an urban setting than practicing in a rural community. Rural communities have to sell themselves when recruiting and retaining doctors. While the economic issues are not the only piece of a recruiting effort, they are a significant issue to a young doctor with a family and perhaps a $120,000 educational loan to repay. The 1989 legislature approved a $5,000 state tax income tax credit supported by the Oregon Association of Hospitals and the Oregon Medical Association and the Office of Rural Health. Talk to anyone involved in rural health, they will tell you of the program's success. It sent a message to doctors that Oregon was serious about having a sustainable rural health delivery system. But that was 15 years ago, and it's time to up the ante. Attaching my testimony is an excellent article published by the Oregon Business Magazine. It's somewhat dated, it was in 2001. While some of the numbers are a little dated, the article captured a true picture of the trials and tribulations of providing rural health care in Oregon. I especially refer to you the four paragraphs on page 23 where a young doctor talks about what motivated him to join the medical staff at Blue Mountain Hospital in John Day and the importance of the tax credit in that decision. I realize that you folks receive a lot of stuff to read and not much of it gets read to you all the time. But I do want to share this with you because I do think it does paint a true picture, and much the same picture as two of the members of this committee saw when we made our tour over in Eastern Oregon in 2000. I want to read just these two paragraphs about what Dr. Graham found when he was being recruited to the hospital there in John Day. And I'm sorry that Senator Verrilli isn't here to receive this. The 32-year-old David Graham is one of the few doctors who has decided to practice on the rural side of the healthcare divide. Quote, I had a lot of faculty at Northwestern University come right out and criticize me for wanting to go into family practice in a rural area, end quote. A physician at Blue Mountain, Dr. Graham, a physician at Blue Mountain Hospital in John Day, nestled between Ochoco and Strawberry Mountains. Quote, they said I could never make a living. Graham and his wife just had their first child, and he admits that his 75-hour work week, split between private practice and the hospital duties, are difficult. But he knew the challenges of rural practice before coming to John Day 3 years ago. He'd worked in Enterprise, Oregon, and in Ontario, Oregon, and with the Indian Health Services as part of the OHSU residency, and he's committed to making a career of his rural practice. The attraction for me has always been the closeness with patients, he says. Out here, I'm the general doctor. I'm the optician. I do surgical work. I'm the pediatrician for the babies I've delivered. It helped that Blue Mountain was aggressively recruiting other physicians to lighten the workload and also offered a safe salary guarantee. In addition, Graham receives assistance repaying his student loans as a member of the National Health Service Corps, and Oregon rural doctors receive a $5,000 personal income tax credit, and a handful of physicians receive loan repayment assistance program in that state. And I have talked to many hospital administrators who have recruited rural physicians, and the tax credit is important. It sends a message to these young docs that have huge financial obligations in most cases and a family to take care of. And I thank you for allowing me to testify and presenting this, and I hope that you will take the time to read this article. It's very, very, very well written. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Scott. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. We, too, support Senate Bill 403, and I'd like to make just a couple of comments about this bill. As you know, Oregon currently is, in our opinion, in the middle of a healthcare crisis in regard to physician workforce. Rural Oregon physicians, as well as throughout the state, the average age is now between 50 and 60. These are physicians who will retire as soon as they possibly can. We're having great difficulty competing in a national and international market to recruit physicians to the state of Oregon to fill what will be the needs for Oregonians in the future. This is a piece of a one tool to be able to do that, where other states offer additional incentives and have kept their incentives more up to date than the state of Oregon. I have spoken to some of the providers who would like to be amended into this bill. I really do appreciate their position of also wanting to benefit from the tax credit, which I and the Medical Association appreciate and understand. However, as you will recall from just two bills ago in this committee, We just had a serious discussion about whether or not the state can afford to potentially appropriate maybe $100,000 to coordinate pharmaceutical medications for those who are poor or elderly. I have tried to indicate to those who were interested in listening to me that my primary concern is we need to begin with the most critical medical providers in the state to begin to lay the base to try to recruit physicians in the state. If additional practitioners make the fiscal untenable in the revenue process and in this legislative process, we obviously would have objections to adding additional practitioners. And while I may be accused, and I'm sure there's some state bar civil penalties, jail time, and other, lashes by, whip or whatever, in reading the bill's relating clause and the actual section of the law that is being amended, it relates to medical practices of physicians or licensees under ORS 677. Here is a section of the law, which is ORS 316.144, which relates to other practitioners, which is not amended by this bill. And while I'm not trying to appear to be stubborn or to get the ire of legislative counsel or the state bar or whomever on my case, I question the ability to broadly amend this bill with the relating clause that it currently has. Mr. Chairman, again, I want to thank you and the committee for consideration of this bill. We clearly believe it's very important and hope you would favorably move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Senator Monasani.
Thank you. This is for Ms. Patterson. Looking at the dash one amendments under section 3, page 2, do you have a copy of the dash?
No, I think that's the pharmacist amendment.
It's the pharmacist, yeah. And it says the Office of Rural Health shall establish criteria for certifying individuals who are licensed as pharmacists under ORS chapter 689. As eligible for the tax credit authorized by ORS 316.144. And so I was wondering, were you aware of that, that then you would need to establish criteria and then take an individual's application?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, that language is fairly, over the years, has been fairly common,
yeah.
Like when the dentists were added, and the Office of Rural Health gets a lot of discretion.
Great.
And I think that would be supportable if the amendment's addressed that way.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Okay. I can't resist Karen Whitaker. Karen, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chair,
if you're in the audience, Karen, I'm going to call on you. And the reason I thought of you is because I was looking at this great picture of you. And,
Mr. Chair, just in case your wife is listening, maybe you ought to qualify that statement.
So
that's a nice
comment. You did just
try
earlier on this bill, and I have your testimony. Is there anything that you would like to add about anything that's being said?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the State Office of Rural Health and the OHSU Center for Rural Health. And I certainly support Senate Bill 403, as I talked with you earlier. I cannot oppose adding additional practitioners that are in great shortage in rural Oregon. Certainly we need pharmacy services. We know that there are rural pharmacies closing all over the state. Certainly we need mental health services. But at the same time, I need to share Mr. Gallant's concern that if we load this bill up too heavily and it has too great a fiscal impact that it might jeopardize its overall success. So I think we have to seek some sort of balance. Insofar as establishing criteria, what we did when we were given that discretion with the dentists was we reminded ourselves that this tax credit is to ensure that rural communities have services. It's not necessarily for the benefit of practitioners. It's for the benefit of rural communities. So we looked around at rural communities to see, number one, where the shortages were and what the problems might be. And so we adopted criteria that required dentists who wanted to participate in this benefit to accept Medicaid patients and to also have an agreement with their local hospital to see emergency patients in the emergency room regardless of their ability to pay. And to this date, we have retained those criteria, and I think we only have maybe 54 at this point dentists who have met that criteria, and we periodically audit to make sure that they do indeed have agreements with their local hospitals. I'm not saying that we would adopt identical criteria for pharmacists or psychologists, but what we would do is try to assess what the need is and where the need is and try to target the credit to meet that need.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, what you're saying then is that there has been no study of the need, and you made a general statement that both mental health staff and pharmacists were there was a shortage in rural Oregon, but you haven't pinpointed where that is. Is there work to be done in those two areas?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is. To my knowledge, no comprehensive survey has been done. I've spent time talking with Tom Holt about this, and we've certainly spent a lot of time gathering anecdotal information from various communities about the shortage of pharmacists and when a rural pharmacy closes and what impact that has on a community. The pharmacy in Merrill closed very recently. The pharmacist was in his 80s. He tried very hard to recruit someone to come and work there and failed. And now they have like a pharmacy ATM in Merrill. I mean, I don't know what else to call it. It's an automated dispensing machine. It's better than nothing, but they no longer have a pharmacist there. And there are other rural communities that have had similar circumstances. But we have not undertaken a systematic survey of that, nor of mental health needs.
Okay, I'll come back to that. Senator Monson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there tax credits in existence now for rural practitioners?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monson-Anderson, yes, there are.
And how much, do you know what that tax credit is now?
The tax credit now, Senator, is $5,000. It applies to physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, some dentists, some optometrists, certified registered nurse anesthetists, and podiatrists.
Okay. So this bill would actually change that and raise that to $10,000 of credit?
That's correct, Senator.
And one other question regarding the psychologists. Have they ever, that you know of, been in a group with being eligible for a tax credit in rural Oregon?
Chair Morissette, Senator Monson-Anderson, no, I don't believe they have. But I think when we talk about raising it to $10,000, we need to also understand that most rural practitioners don't make enough income to incur $10,000 worth of tax liability. And so the revenue impact will not double at this point. It will go in increments. But the last time we surveyed all of our rural practitioners about their income, only 87% of them were taking the full credit.
And follow up, did you mention pharmacists in that or not?
Senator Monson-Anderson, no, that pharmacists are not currently eligible.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was good, important testimony.
Thank you very much.
Daniana Merriweather and Tom Holt, would you please come up and make your best case?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Marquette and members of the committee. I'm sad to see that Senator Sturt had to leave. But I am here on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association. My name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here to present to you the Dash 2 amendments, which you all have discussed already a bit, which would add psychologists to the list of qualified providers. As Karen Whitaker stated, she talked to you a little bit about who currently is qualified under the existing statute to qualify for this. And as she ran out the list, I'm sure you noticed, and she clarified, there are no specified mental health professionals that are there, and this is an area of tremendous need in rural communities. And I don't think that any of you would actually question that per se about whether that's, I'm sure you've heard, so I don't want to belabor that. What our amendment does, there are basically two pieces. One is it adds psychologists to the list of qualified providers. And two, it actually has a delayed implementation of 2009. So there would be no additional fiscal impact to this bill as it's written now this biennium. It's a delayed rollout as a way for us to actually promote this with graduates coming out of Oregon, graduate programs in psychology, encouraging them to stay in Oregon, to settle in Oregon, establish practices. We just think it would be, that alone would be tremendous. In the testimony I presented to you, I've actually brought three very short anecdotes that I've gathered from psychologists that I work with the association. Dr. Douglas Marlowe in Pendleton, who practices seeing clients from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 6 days a week. He does take an hour for lunch and goes for a run, he told me. And has been, he's got a 3-month wait now for new patients. He has desperately been trying to recruit. And of those folks he has looked at, those psychologists he has looked at to recruit, they have all ultimately ended up deciding to locate in more urban areas. I also have a little bit of information from Dr. David Wade, who is with Providence Hood River Memorial Hospital, and their rural setting also really presents some challenges for them in recruiting. They have been advertising for a therapist to run their alcohol and drug program since September, and they're now considering closing the program. Not because the program isn't needed, but because they struggle so much with recruiting qualified personnel. And then finally, Dr. Robin Henderson, who's runs the mental health clinic at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, and she has struggled over the last year as the three psychiatrists who were supposed to be provide support for her clinical program there have all decided not to do what they had committed to do, and she's now going to Seattle trying to find someone that she can recruit to help her even part-time in meeting the clinical needs there. So, that's just a flavor of what I got and a very simple request from membership to asking our role providers about what their experience was. That is the short version of what I got. I'm more than happy to answer your questions.
Yes. Yeah. Senator Montana.
Thank you. Do you have a grid that shows how many psychologists are located in rural Oregon? I mean, by city or by area?
I don't have that with me, Senator, but I can provide that. I can tell you currently as using the parameters of the statutes that exist for other providers, there are approximately 120 psychologists who would qualify for part or all of their practicing in those designated areas. One of the things that Karen Whitaker spoke to was sort of management tools for identifying where there are areas of need and structuring the capacity to qualify, as they've done with Dennis. And we would be the psychologists would be very open and willing to work with that sort of management tool that would allow the Office of Rural Health to really focus the solution at where the problem is. In that context, I don't have that list with me, but I could provide it for you and the whole committee. Thank you.
Thanks. You mentioned to me earlier today that Representative Butler has a concern. Representative Butler is from Ontario.
Yes. The amendment that I am proposing is actually a verbatim of House Bill 2514, which has been introduced by Representative Butler, Chair of Revenue Committee. Because he, again, being a legislator from an outlying community, has seen firsthand the challenges of recruiting mental health providers to those communities, and feels very, very strongly about that. And we are going to continue to pursue that through the House, but we saw this bill, which was very much relating to the same issue, as something that was moving, and we decided it would be more efficient for us to join in with one piece instead of running multiple pieces through the process.
Good.
Okay. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I'm here in support of the Dash 1 amendment. Our issue, as it relates to this with pharmacies and pharmacists, is very similar to that of the medical profession, in that our workforce in the very rural areas is substantially older than the urban workforce, and the salaries that pharmacies are able to offer in these small communities are substantially less than what a pharmacist can earn in, say, Portland or Eugene or even Salem, by a factor of perhaps 25% to 35% less. So having access to the tax credit would be a great help. We would submit that if you don't have pharmacy services, you really don't have a health care network in a community. Over the last number of years, there's been a real shift in health care, and that we do rely more on prescription drugs as a primary form of treatment for many things. And that has changed since this credit was first enacted way back. What we have drafted, cognizant of the budgetary situation and also trying to focus on where our problem really lies, is an amendment that attempts to very narrowly qualify people who would be working at small, mostly independent pharmacies as the first level of qualification. We did some research in our database and came up with a number of about 139 people at most would qualify under the criteria that we have laid out here, and that will be before the Office of Rural Health, and we work together to narrow that funnel still more to a reasonable number of people in the communities that have real need, you know, such as Merrill, where we recently lost a pharmacy.
So you have done some survey work.
We have, as best we can, in our database, we have access to, you know, age and practice location, and some of those kind of demographics. We're also, because it's our job, are in pretty close touch with where there are pending needs to recruit people, or else we're going to see a pharmacy close in the next few years. So that's why we're bringing this forward. What we have described here as qualifying is people who work in a group of work for a pharmacy that's not part of a group of more than five pharmacies under common ownership. That basically describes the small independent pharmacies in the smaller communities, and then otherwise as designated by the Office of Rural Health. And we would expect to be working with the Office of Rural Health to further define what criteria would qualify someone for this. You know, to put that number of potential qualifying people in some perspective, if I recall correctly, there's a total of something just a little bit north of 1,000 people in total participate in this program. So we will be a small piece of what we think is an important program to provide health care in rural Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing, and we are not going to have a work session on this bill because we don't have enough people. We still don't have enough people. We're going to carry this one. Stanities. Senate Bill 403.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 403.
Senator Cruz moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 403. Discussion? Any objection? Dash 1 amendments are part of 403.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 403.
Senator Cruz moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 403. Discussion? Objection? Okay.
Discussion.
Yes. Discussion?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am concerned about tax credits. This is going to be referred to revenue, and I know the need, and so if they need to pull, they can pull things out, and so that's why I feel comfortable in voting for this and sending it to revenue.
Okay. Thank you. And I would also say that because two rural legislators are support this bill, support the amendments, and I think it's important that we move it along, and it will go to revenue, and decisions will be made. It will go to the House, and decisions will be made, and so this is the first step. Would you call, okay.
Mr. Chair, we need needed
two amendments
are adopted. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 403 as amended to the Senate Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 403 with the dash one amendments and the dash two amendments that have been adopted to forward it to the Revenue Committee. Okay. Would you please call roll?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Mester?
Wait a minute. Senator Mester, excuse.
Senator Montana?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Senator Starr, excuse.
Senator
Aye. Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 403. Now we have an interesting bill before us that we had not planned to hear, but it was inadvertently scheduled for a public hearing and a work session. And I turned away two people who had a personal interest in this because I assured them that this bill was inadvertently put on the schedule. But since there is tremendous interest in this bill, we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 609 and Gordon, Foltz, and Company. Anyone else who would like to?
Can I talk about the bill?
Gordon, you come up and get seated, and then we'll describe the bill. Rick, would you like to describe the bill, or would you like to introduce and describe the bill? Mr. Committee Administrator, would you describe the bill, and then Senator Cruz can correct any misconceptions that any of us might have.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 609 modifies the statute related to the direction of county commissioners and local commissions on children and families regarding commission duties.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Would you like to step down and testify?
You want me to?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
You know, I'd be more than happy.
Good.
Does this mean
you're now? 885. Yeah. Okay. Senate Bill 88. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead. Yes.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee. Well, it's what's there. For the record, I'm State Senator Jeff Cruz, and I want to thank you for the surprise scheduling of this bill. Initially, we drafted this bill because it had a very wonderful and very broad relating clause and a subject area that it appears, at least the Senate, is not going to delve into deeply. And when I saw that it was scheduled, I took a look at the bill and trying to remember, because this was a bill I had drafted last session, what the intent was. And really, from my perspective, this does not change authority or responsibility of anybody. And because the main part of the bill, what it does is it takes what is currently, if you read the bill, lines 5 and 6 and moves them down to line 13 and 14 without really changing the content of that language. So what this does, basically, is it will change in statute to where it says what the main purpose of the local commission on children and families are to A, B, and C. And so that's the mission statement. The mission statement stays the same. And then basically what it says is under direction of the board or boards of county commissioners and in conjunction with the guidelines set by the State Commission on Children and Families, the local commission shall. And that gets into the list of action items. So really what it does is it sets the mission
and then sets the authority over the action items. And I think it's a cleaner way for it to appear in statute. The only other real substantive changes, line 16, page 1, where it changes the word citizen to community, which is truly what the commissions are doing, is involving the whole community. And on page 3, line 15, it changes citizens to residents, because clearly in a lot of, especially rural parts of the state, not all residents are citizens, so that's a more inclusive term. Those are really the substantive changes. It doesn't change authority. I think it just makes it read better.
Okay. Gordon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties, again here for an unexpected hearing. But let me just tell you, we have, I guess, some concerns, and Senator Cruz may have taken care of those. Our concerns are basically why the language is being moved, because before, the language about the Board of Commissioners and the State Commission qualified the three parts of the mission statement that Senator Cruz has just referred to. So as I look at that, for instance, line number 11, for instance, it says develop policy and oversee the implementation of a local coordinated comprehensive plan. If you move on down, you do not see that language under what is now the new sub 2, which would suggest that somehow that is a mission statement, and or the other way to interpret that is that's something that they do without any review by the Board of Commissioners. And that's, I guess, the concern that I originally raised. I'm not sure that this doesn't diminish the potential authority and the responsibility of the Board to review this, but I can also understand the other reading of that, which is that it's a mission statement, then that's what it does. So we're coming with a little confusion as to what this language is intended to do.
Yeah. Your confusion is shared by many of us here, because we weren't expecting to hear this bill. There were others who wished to testify if we were going to hear it, and I told them that we were not. So we're going to bring this back, perhaps. No.
Thank you.
Commissioner, did you want to testify?
Good.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 609. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 885. Yes, and Monty Burke. Yeah, Roy, would you come up also? Roy Scheer. And there's a little bit of confusion perhaps on this bill in terms of jurisdiction and what the state authority is. So, Roy, would you identify yourself, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Roy Scheer, and I work for the office of Senator Charlie Ringo, who is the chief sponsor of this bill. Some of the concerns that you mentioned about jurisdiction I wish to address today in my testimony. First of all, I want to tell you a little bit about the background of this bill. We requested this bill be drafted as a result of a letter from a constituent of ours who was a recipient of both Social Security benefits and also Oregon Food Stamp benefits. On the 1st of January 2005, her Social Security income was increased by $23 as a result of the cost of living adjustment. What happened as a result of this adjustment was that the Oregon Food Stamp benefit that she also received was reduced by $10. Ultimately, even though this was a net increase in her income, it was not the full amount intended by the Social Security benefit. So, there's a chart attached to my written testimony, which I think that has been distributed. This is an example that was brought to me by Sue Abrams from the Department of Health and Human Services, of Human Services. And in this chart, you'll note that this is an example of a calculation of a person who receives both Social Security benefits and food stamp benefits exclusively. There are certain deductions that are factored into this that also affect the formula, but assuming that those deductions don't change in both cases, you'll notice that also the when the Social Security benefit is increased, the food stamp benefit is also decreased in that case as well, resulting in, even though it's a net increase, it's not the full cost of living adjustment as determined by Social Security. Both our constituent and our office agree that the formula in its present state undermines the full amount of the full cost of living adjustment as recommended by the Social Security Administration. There are two potential problems that I've discussed with Sue Abrams from the Department of Human Services. The first problem is the jurisdiction issue. Federal law may prohibit states from fine-tuning their food stamp formula benefit, or the formula for the food stamp benefits. And the consequence of changing this benefit through legislation actually may be that the federal government could revoke funding from the program. However, our office has done investigation on this issue, and we found two Supreme Court cases which deal with this jurisdiction issue. Currently, we've put in a request to the Legislative Council to further explore this issue and determine whether or not the state has the ability to adjust the formula and still maintain the funding for the program. The second issue that I discussed with Ms. Abrams was the issue of administrative barriers to this formula change. I've spoken with her about this issue, and we've determined that working on a few amendments to the bill may help alleviate some of the administrative costs that may be associated with changing the formula. And so we're working with Ms. Abrams on that issue as well. If anybody from the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Well, I have some questions, but let's wait until we hear Monty's testimony.
Certainly.
Would you please introduce yourself? And
thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty Burke. I am a program manager with the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits in the Department of Human Services. I'm here to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 885. The department is opposed to the bill not because we disagree with the intent of the bill, which we believe is to allow unchanged benefit level after the cost of living increase, but because we feel that the federal regulations do not allow us to disregard that annual adjustment. The food stamp program is a federal program, and the benefits are 100% federal funds. The administrative costs are shared evenly between the state and the federal government. And when we take the option to administer that program, we must adhere to all of the rules, regulations that govern the program, unless we have options to deviate from those regulations. The non-compliance of not following those regulations, we feel, would result in a further risk to quality control errors and possible penalties and loss of federal funding. And we understand that the sponsor is exploring possibilities that a few court cases may support the position that we have the authority to implement this legislation. And if that is correct, we still have some concerns, as mentioned, regarding the fiscal impact. The cost of implementing the bill are still being assessed. However, the increased costs would come as a result of system changes and increased risk of quality control errors, and also an increased workload due to caseload increases and time spent reconciling the difference in income as reported by the current match with Social Security and what we would actually count towards the calculation of food stamp benefits. We are, as I mentioned, working with the sponsor to explore other options to come to the same end. And we appreciate the benefit to households whose food stamps would not be reduced as a result of this bill. Costs are not contained in the governor's recommended budget. Thanks for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah. Did you have a question? Okay. My
immediate feeling, and I discussed this with my legislative assistant, who informed me that he, as a newspaper columnist several years ago, ran into a similar situation where a person's Social Security benefits went up, and so they lost some state benefits as a result of that. And one recourse will be to contact our congressional delegation to see if we could make some changes in the adjustments in the federal law to not penalize the individual who loses the Oregon health plan because their Social Security benefits go up just a little bit to disqualify them. That would be one solution. The other one would be to pass a statute requiring that the state not deny benefits due to federal reductions. However, that could jeopardize our federal funding, so that is something. But I think it's a bad situation, and it's one of those bureaucratic glitches that occur, and I'm sure there are all kinds of them between the feds and the states. But this is a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I hope that we can resolve it, so... Thank you very much.
If I may make another comment, I'd be happy to, once our office hears back from Legislative Council on that determination, we'd be happy to testify again. And
well, I'd like us to, we'll wait and see what we hear from Legislative Council and then decide what to do. But aside from that, we're still going to pursue it on the federal level. We are going to do that and see if we can get our congressional delegation to... raise that issue and change it for the benefit of the people in the states who would lose state benefits because they get a slight increase in a federal program. That doesn't make sense. So we will work on that. Thank you for your patience and waiting.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we will close the public hearing and we will adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you.